Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've just lived through a succession of the hottest years on record, each warmer than the next, and there is no reason to believe that will change in the coming years. In fact, one study by the National Academy of Sciences predicts that within the next 50 years, the planet could experience a greater temperature increase than in the last 6,000. The study says by 2100, temperatures could rise to the point that just going outside for a few hours in some places, including parts of India and eastern China, will result in death for even the fittest of humans. And the United States is not immune. A changing climate is producing substantial alterations in weather dynamics. The California fire season has now stretched into the state's rainy season. That season is now, but there has been no rain. And fires have ravaged major portions of Los Angeles. Here at home, many people long considered Asheville a climate haven, even ranking it high on a list of places expected to see a surge in people moving there to avoid the worst of climate change. Until Hurricane Helene. Much of what is to come is in this warming world is still unknown. What is known is that if it continues, we will continue to see changes in agriculture and eventually migrations of large numbers of people as they search for more livable conditions. We're going to examine that this hour with Lawrence Huang. He's a policy analyst with the Migration Policies Institute's International Program, who works on climate and migration. Tina Scholl is a public historian of race, immigration enforcement, and climate migration in the United States and around the world as an associate professor of history at UNC Charlotte. And Alexandra Tempest is a freelance journalist whose work focuses on how climate changes where and how we live and reporting from communities throughout the country uprooted by the changing climate's impact. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome. So the impetus for us to explore this topic came from a guest essay in the New York Times written by Dr. Peter Kalmus, who's at UNC Chapel Hill. He's a climate scientist who studies heat impacts on human health and ecosystems. And he moved from Los Angeles 2 years ago to North Carolina because as the climate kept getting drier and hotter, he feared that his neighborhood would burn. But he says he wouldn't have predicted anything like what's going on out there in Los Angeles right now. And he says, quote, "One lesson climate change teaches us again and again is that bad things can happen ahead of schedule. And now the heating is accelerating, outpacing scientists' expectations." He is but one man, though a climate scientist, who already migrated because of a changing climate. Alexandra, I know you lived in Los Angeles a couple of years ago when it was overly rainy, and now you're in Wisconsin where it's cold, but there's little snow on the ground. I have to ask you, and we'll talk about the impact of climate change in North Carolina already, but I have to ask you, is any place safer than another? Is any place immune?
Mike, in my opinion, there's never been such a thing as a climate haven. You know, Los Angeles in January 2023, 2 Januaries ago, by January 17th, had seen 9 back-to-back atmospheric rivers. It had seen school closures and trees falling over into the streets, eerily reminiscent to the trees falling over in the streets now due to hurricane force winds propelling unprecedented wildfire across, you know, an area of Los Angeles multiple times the size of Manhattan. So what we're seeing here is that even dependably sunny, temperate Southern California has now been tossed into this new nexus of uncertainty. And there is no way of pinning down, you know, a place that is altogether insulated from climate impacts. And I don't think many people try to claim that. However, there is a large, you know, cottage industry springing up around predicting, you know, where is best to develop and build and move. This is a growing business. And we can talk about some of what might be motivating that and what some of the reality on the ground might look like and how that might be different than what we're seeing them, you know, modeling predict. But no, and I don't think there is such a thing as a climate haven. And you talked about Dr. Kalmus moving to North Carolina, you know, from Los Angeles. Well, there he was confronted shortly with Hurricane Helene and all of the, you know, devastation that that brought. And then the Southeast back-to-back blizzards in recent months. So was it, has it been a haven for him? You know, has, you know, so that's my question.
I know you're in Wisconsin, so you don't know the geography of North Carolina all that well, but the Chapel Hill is about 4 or 5 hours away from the mountains where that took place. It's just so you know, we're a very wide state. It takes a long time to get from the mountains to the beaches. Dr. Kalmus points out in his article in the New York Times that no one is coming to save us from what's going to happen. That means that we have to come to save us. We have to take action. As you've looked at this around the country, Alexandria, in the course of your reporting, have you found some governments are doing this better than others, or that any of them are taking any steps to stave this off in their own communities? Because the federal government may not be taking many steps in the coming years.
Right. Well, I feel like that's where I find a lot of hope, and that's what's driven my reporting, are examples of local communities that have, you know, taken things into their own hands and are devising community-driven plans to relocate portions of their community to higher ground, for example, or, you know, to find ways of removing housing that is vulnerable along river ways. This is, I think, you know, the most proactive sort of action that's being taken on, you know, addressing climate migration. There are also municipalities that are marketing themselves as destination cities and trying to prepare for what they see, think could be an influx of people. And so there are governments, local governments, that are making plans, making efforts. How far they can get without consistent and robust federal funding is an open question. And under Trump, it'll be, you know, interesting.
Lawrence Huang is with us. He is a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. And Lawrence, you have written that, quote, hotter temperatures can threaten agricultural livelihoods, sea level rise can make floods more severe, and desertification can foster conflict over water access. We used to associate those things with poorer countries, with poor infrastructure, etc. Are we now going to face those same challenges in this country?
To a degree, absolutely, yes. But I don't want to overemphasize it. I would say that when we're talking about increased temperatures, sea level rise, drought, desertification, extreme weather events, these types of shocks have always hurt and damaged high-income countries and low-income countries. The worst hit are not just low-income countries, but also low-income communities and the poor and the vulnerable communities who lack the resources to move and evacuate before a disaster, or to move to higher ground, or to live in safer places. But this is a global issue. The United States has always experienced displacement due to disasters. That has been increasing. We do have data from the Census Bureau showing us that we have tens of thousands of American adults who are forced to move every year because of disasters. This is not just a sort of global South or a poor country problem anymore.
Tina, some have estimated that between 150 million and 1 billion people will be displaced by the changing climate by 2050. That's just 25 years from now. So people think of that being way out there. It's not. It's right around the corner. And by the end of the century, as much as 39% of the global population, 8 billion people, could live in environments outside of the human climate niche, which provides the most appropriate conditions for human habitation. So do you think those numbers are accurate?
Hi, that's a really great question. As much as climate change displaces people, migration researchers have also been finding that it renders people stuck in place in many instances. And so these numbers and predictions, such as that of the World Bank's report, I think it was 2018, have been critiqued by migration researchers as, they're really hard to predict. It's really hard to, as you said, as Peter Kalma said, impacts can actually come earlier or hit heavier than predicted. Modeling is not, entirely accurate always. And then also how we count and measure migration is very varied. And so there's voluntary migration, there's forced migration, and there is very local migrations that often happen first and foremost when people are displaced. So there's a lot of internal migration. I think over 90% of so-called climate migration is internal, within nation states, but even hyper-local. So it's important to include the immobility that climate change can also bring, not only due to borders and bordering policies that disallow people from moving, which is what we're seeing that at the border right now, in the wake of Trump's executive orders yesterday. But also social policies that have set up patterns of historical disadvantage. That includes poverty, people having or lacking access to rights, privileges, or resources to be able to move. So we're starting to see this simultaneous movements of the more privileged and movements of the disadvantaged, and those can be measured and counted in various ways. So I can't say that those numbers are entirely inaccurate. A lot of great data methodology has gone into them and those predictions. But I would note that one word of caution about such numbers is that it tends to raise a sort of panic around the discussion, and a sort of it can fuel anti-immigrant sentiment or just a lot of fear and anxiety. And climate anxiety is something I talk a lot about with my students, and is something that really stymies our ability to have, productive conversations about how to build resilience.
And I do want to talk about that a little bit later on. But if these numbers that I just spewed out, if they're even close to being accurate, even if they fall short, they're enormous numbers. Do we know which parts of the world are going to be most affected by this enormous number of people who are going to have to move, if they can, to continue living in an environment that is hospitable to human habitation?
Yes, there has been some recent reporting that shows that predominantly areas in the global south will be most heavily impacted, especially by rising temperatures. So those living closest to the equator. And so what does that mean for, wealthier nations in the global north? Policies of increasing border enforcement are not the ideal response, I would argue.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that because that obviously affects us, or could affect us in the future. Tina Scholl is an associate professor of history, public history at UNC Charlotte. She's here with Lawrence Huang with the Migration Policy Institute and Alexandra Tempest, a freelance journalist. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about climate change and its impact in the future, particularly with regard to migration. with Lawrence Huang, policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute's International Program. Tina Scholl is a public historian who focuses on race, immigration enforcement, and climate migration within the country. She's at UNC Charlotte. And Alexandra Tempest is a freelance journalist who has reported extensively on this. Lawrence, you wanted to point out that, if it helps, you say, the billion-person estimate that I threw out there a minute ago, people who may be displaced by climate change by 2050, it's an estimate based on poor methods. Do you have better numbers?
The billion-person estimate isn't ideal because it's a very rough estimate of the number of people who are going to be extremely badly impacted by climate change. But we can't jump from there and say the billion will move. And I think that's the issue that we often find with the estimates like that. We can get pretty good estimates of who's badly affected, but we don't know that they're going to move because, like Tina said, so many people who are so badly affected by climate shocks will still lack the resources to move. We have very good estimates of how many people will move within their countries in low and middle income countries. So the World Bank's report puts a number of around up to 216 million. That's a really large number. We know that that's primarily going to be people moving from rural areas to urban areas to the large cities. And we know that there is some of that that will cross borders and some of that will come to high income countries like the United States. But at least from the data that we're seeing so far, the way that climate change is making people move, it's not mass climate migration. It's that climate change makes it really hard to have a job or to make an agricultural living or to not see floods continuously destroying the roads and the bridges around you. And so there's all of these more indirect factors that may make people move. But I tend to take issue with the billion person estimate.
And Alexandra, I know that you have a perspective on those numbers as well.
Well, I so appreciate Tina and Lawrence both bringing up that those estimates can be problematic and pointing out the World Bank numbers. Because prior to the World Bank report, what we had was largely, and this is what Alex DeSherbinin at Columbia University told me, largely back of the envelope estimates. So that's what we were dealing with prior to 2018. In the World Bank report, they look specifically at internal migration within specific countries, sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and South Asia. They found that there were certain places that were hotspots to move to. So they're targeting hyper-local migration, sort of changes the way that we think about how climate migration can look. Because here in the U.S., we're seeing a lot of the same phenomenon play out. People largely don't want to leave their communities if they don't have to. If they're forced to leave, if they lose their home to environmental disaster, they often relocate. Paper out in Environmental Research Letters in 2023 said that most relocate within 20 miles of their previous residence. And they still effectively reduce their exposure to climate risk in doing so.
You wrote an article that focused on this number to illustrate what could be a dramatic number of people migrating to more hospitable areas, but you say it ignores the nuances that could better serve public policymakers, because most people, you say, who move because of the climate usually do so slowly over time, and usually they don't move very far.
Right, yes. Some of the scholars I was talking to spoke with folks in Benin, in East Africa, for example, asking them, why they rebuilt their home after coastal erosion had swept the old one away. Why did you move? Just so, and what these scholars found when they talked to locals was that they didn't consider themselves as having moved, that they felt as though they had always lived in this area. And so it's sort of a reconception of how we think of who is a migrant. We talk about 90% of climate migration being internal, or something along those lines. This is, sort of what we have to think of when we think of how it's playing out in the U.S.
And this is
It's internal, and people are moving, relatively close to where they live, unless they belong to certain very mobile populations.
because perhaps it is because the idea of immigration has become political, and the idea of climate change has also become political, that any efforts to combat it have become emotional issues for many people, Lawrence. Should they be emotional issues? And how do we get beyond this? If you're a policymaker and you're facing political blowback and people are screaming at you because it's emotional, how do you make policy?
Yes, I mean that's the question of the moment, isn't it? It's incredibly hard to make good policy, especially good policy that takes a long time to implement and to succeed when public opinion isn't there. It doesn't support that type of policy making. I think the question isn't whether this issue should be emotional. It is emotional for people. This is not an American issue only. This is not a North Carolina issue only. This is almost every high-income country that has traditionally received immigrants and done a good job of doing so is facing blowback against that. And a lot of that comes down to people's real experiences of inflation, of housing shortages, alongside government's inability to manage migration in a well-ordered way. There are ways that we can manage inflows of people so that that the public feels like this is secure, that this is a process that the government has control over. And I think over the last few years, especially after COVID and the sort of massive rebound of migration that came out of that, we have seen public opinion turn against migration in particularly bad ways.
And Tina, this has led to a rise in populism here and around the world, mostly because of people feeling threatened by immigration. There's a little strain of xenophobia going through a lot of folks out there, because they come in and they speak a different language and they have different cultural customs that they bring with them, and they people feel threatened that their customs will have to change, their country will have to change. This is just the tip of the iceberg, and a lot of this immigration that we're experiencing around the world right now, some of it is affected by climate change, but much of it is not. It's political, it's other aspects. When climate begins to get the upper hand and people are moving north because they can't live where they live now, if we can't deal with this, how do we deal with it when it happens on a larger scale?
It's a great question, and I think that education is key. As an educator, I will say that and defend, the study of history, especially for understanding the kind of origins of these issues and how they came to be politicized. And that's how I came into studying this topic as an immigration historian, and then realizing that the overlaps with the history of environmentalism and climate change and these issues are very interrelated, and the way they specifically have been kind of politicized and weaponized in this country in our context is very important to understand the denial and the misinformation that is circulating around it. Unfortunately, xenophobia is a very long-standing American tradition, but there is so many myths and untruths about immigration. The first and foremost being that it is harmful to the economy, which time and time again researchers can demonstrate that that is false, or that it contributes to crime, and that's also false. And I don't want to support an argument about immigrant deservingness that can be divisive, but this is where we are, where there is just a growing number of people who do not have the facts. And it is an emotional issue.
I want to talk about those facts and come back to those numbers in a second because we have to have facts in order to make intelligent decisions. But Lawrence, you wanted to chime in, I believe.
Yes, so we did some research into this, looking at how public opinion reacts to immigration and refugee flows. And what strikes me is that it's not just the number of people and the fact that we might see larger flows of people because of climate change, because Public opinion isn't always just focused on how many people are coming. It's how people feel about whether it is an ordered process, whether we have control over it. So if we it's the sort of spontaneity and the randomness and the feeling that we don't have control over who's entering into this country, rather than just the number of people who enter this country, that according to some of the public opinion polling is what matters. So if we could manage this process in an orderly way with legal processes, with good vetting systems. There are ways that we could do this that allow people to enter that don't necessarily alienate the public.
Alexandra, we have known, at least climate scientists have known and said for a while now, that the climate is changing, that the world is getting warmer. We've had three, I think, or four years. Each year successively is warmer than the previous. But there's still climate change denial going on out there, as witnessed by Donald Trump yesterday, revoking our participation in the Paris Climate Treaty, which will take place in about a year, and that we can talk about what that may or may not do going forward. But I also threw out all these numbers about climate change and its impact on migration. And there's a question about, as we've talked about already, whether those numbers are close to being accurate. And you wrote an article about this, and you quote one political scientist that's calling those predictions, and I quote, full of crap. So how do we make intelligent decisions if we can't agree on the numbers?
Well, in the few years, the good news is that, excuse me, coming off a cold. In the few years since that article came out, and right really as that article was published, the World Bank was publishing its first report that was accurate, the first accurate climate migration report. Excuse me. And so what we saw then was something that we could then base and use as a methodologically sound projection. And it has only been revised in years since then, to be more accurate. But so, and what's interesting and what I pointed out a few minutes ago about that report is that it does focus in on internal migration. It does recognize that that is how we get a more the most accurate count of climate migration happening on the ground.
Lawrence,
Is it
words.
on internal migration within countries? And so that is something that scholars have come to agree on, and that we're seeing more and more people acknowledge that climate migration on the ground, even though we may have many millions moving, they may not move big, long cross-country distances. They might be moving more locally.
Let me talk about that, Lawrence, because I think words matter, and perhaps we're using the wrong words. When we say migration, we think of people crossing borders, coming great distances to escape one thing or another, and coming into your territory. But as we have said, much of this migration is internal. When people leave Miami Beach because it's going to go underwater, and they migrate to Orlando, we don't consider that migration. That's just moving. So, should we have better words? Are we paying attention to the wrong thing here? Are we thinking too much about migration across borders and not enough about people moving internally because of climate change?
Well, there's a reason I
No,
use the
no,
word.
hold on. I'm asking that question to Lawrence. I'm sorry. Go
Oh, I'm
ahead.
sorry.
That's all right.
The short answer is yes. We are absolutely not focused enough on the worst impacts, and that's on internal climate migration or internal climate mobility. I'm not going to say that I have a great word that captures all the nuances of this type of movement. We have sometimes used the word mobility because I feel like that doesn't make you immediately think of cross-border mass migration to countries like the US, when that's not what's happening. It is mobility. It is people moving from one town to another within their country, people moving to from their farming village to the capital city. I think at the very min at minimum, we should be clear about when we're talking about climate migration, most of the time it's internal climate migration.
So, Tina, you have a local example of this because you were project director of a Charlotte Museum exhibit called Climates of Inequality that examined the impact of people movement or migration on poor communities within our city because of climate change. What did you find?
Yeah, thank you. I love this conversation about terms and terminology and how debatable they are, and how there really is no definition for so-called or quote-unquote climate refugee in international or U.S. law, and so it's not a legal category. And then the question of migration, you can use terms instead, such as mobility and immobility. I think they're really important. Point here is, especially when you're looking at the United States, is to make sure that the conversation is capacious or broad enough to be inclusive of Indigenous and Black communities, who are most often the heaviest hit by the impacts of climate change. And so if we think of migration more broadly in terms of the longer historical trajectory of the impacts and legacies of forced migration and enslavement, for example, or Native American removal and disenfranchisement, then we can get a better picture of different forms of movement, migration, forced, voluntary, involuntary, etc. And so that's why when I actually came from California as well, and I'm a fourth generation Angeleno. And so seeing the impact of the LA fires has been really devastating. And I came to Charlotte in 2020 for this position. And we realized I came together with colleagues, students, interested community members to form a conversation about climate change and migration. And we started realizing that we needed to drill down and go very, very local in order to unpack all the complexity of these issues, and to really understand the contingency of climate migration in a place like Charlotte, where you have a history of, for example, redlining and segregation and urban renewal, which has really important environmental and environmental justice dimensions, because it was the pollution of the creek system through the textile mills that justified to the city the cause for removal of blight. And so that was a big environmental injustice. And to this day, communities are impacted by forms of environmental racism across the city that may be included in this conversation.
Tina Scholz, Associate Professor and Director of Public History at UNC Charlotte. We will continue in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Tina Scholl is with us, Associate Professor of Public History at UNC Charlotte, who focuses on climate migration and other aspects of migration. Lawrence Huang is a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. Alexandra Tempest writes about this as a freelance journalist. And Alexandra, hundreds of thousands of U.S. census blocks have already been identified as having passed tipping points for abandonment, meaning people need to leave and go elsewhere, either because their land is being swallowed up by water, as it's happening in Louisiana, where I think they lose about a football size area every 100 minutes. Those areas contain about 16 million people in the United States. And one report focusing on that statistic claims that soon whole counties across Florida and central Texas could begin to see their total populations decline. There are certainly economic consequences to that, so those predictions could turn out to be wrong, but can local and state governments, or the federal government for that matter, ignore those numbers?
Certainly not. But they are being ignored largely at the federal level. I think that there are agencies that are moving to act, that under Biden had been moving to act, fund climate adaptation more proactively. But it remains to be seen if that will continue in the coming years. whether these localities, as I mentioned earlier, are doing, a lot of them are doing really great work. I've profiled communities in Texas where there are buyouts happening at large scales and neighborhoods relocating in as in, you know, kind of in chunks away from vulnerable watershed areas. So there are local governments, like I said, that are doing things about it because the residents are in imminent danger at imminent risk. Yeah, and so when we think about, you know, I just to touch, circle back a little bit to the conversation earlier, you know, when we see people who are moving like this in these, maybe these people in these counties will end up moving one or several more counties away. Maybe they'll end up moving to a, you know, an urban area nearby. Well, it remains to be seen. That's what some of the climate projections might have us thinking. But, you know, the reason we would say these people are climate migrants and why I use that term instead of climate refugees is because that, you know, international law doesn't recognize anything such as a climate refugee. So there's no protection afforded to anyone who has the label of climate refugee. And what climate migration experts tell me is that it likely wouldn't help.
Lawrence, is that likely to change? I mean, even if it wouldn't help. I mean, we have refugees who are recognized as being refugees for various different political reasons. As the climate warms and people are forced to move, are governments likely to recognize them as climate migrants or climate refugees?
Broadly speaking, no. That's not just because governments aren't in a particularly in a mood to expand the refugee convention and expand legal protections for refugees at the moment. Really, the political movement is in the other direction. What we've argued based off some research we've been doing is that it's not just unlikely to happen. It's perhaps impossible to do because we don't have a clear, easy definition of who is forced to move because of climate change, who's a climate migrant, who's a climate refugee. If we try and create a new international law requiring states to open up borders to a community of people called climate refugees, I'm not quite sure where we draw the boundaries of that, because everybody's affected in some way, shape, or form by climate change, and millions of people are displaced by it. So it's there are political reasons why this isn't going to happen, at least in the, I mean, honestly, the medium to long term. But there are also practical reasons why it would be really hard to set up that type of system.
This is happening. The impacts of climate change is happening worldwide. We are now beginning to see it here. Perhaps that'll bring it into clearer focus, perhaps not. The change in climate is clearly responsible for the flooding in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, just as it is responsible for the fires in Los Angeles going on right now, in which 160,000 people have been displaced. Over 14,000 homes were destroyed. Some of those folks will try to stay and rebuild. Others will certainly move out of LA, perhaps out of state. As I mentioned, it is said that areas of land the size of a football field are lost in Louisiana to rising sea levels every 100 minutes. Hurricane Helene in our state destroyed lives and businesses and homes and roads and bridges. Inevitably, some people will leave the mountains of North Carolina. But we've always had natural disasters around the world. Are these displacements being caused by climate more frequent? Are they impacting more people's lives than ever before? Or are we making a mountain out of a molehill, Lawrence?
We know that climate change makes disasters more frequent. We know climate change makes disasters more severe. That is very clear from the climate science. It is too early to do any sort of proper climate attribution science with the LA fires. When it came to Hurricane Helene, we have estimates from climate scientists that climate change may have boosted the amount of rainfall during the hurricane, that It was the rainfall was heavier and was more likely because of climate change. So the types of disasters we're seeing aren't new. We've always had hurricanes, we've always had wildfires, but their severity, their frequency, where they're hitting, that's changing as the world warms and as the climate worsens. So this is not a radically new type of movement, but it is something that we need to be better prepared for. We need to be investing to help people stay and helping them move in a way as well, in safe ways, because it's getting worse.
Tina, you're an historian, a person who looks backward to see what clues they can discover about the future, I suppose. So I'm going to ask you to look into the future for a moment here. As these disasters become more frequent, become more severe, etc., is this going, do you think, if history is any indication, is it going to cause people to demand policy changes?
I believe so, and we are seeing some of that, although we are also seeing how divisive these events have been, in terms of them becoming politicized and having a lot of misinformation or disinformation swirling around them, as we saw with Hurricane Helene, and with the fires in Los Angeles. Hurricane Helene, for example, it's considered, in many reports, a 1,000-year flood event. And I actually was teaching two courses in the fall. One was about climate migration in the US South. And ironically, sadly, we were learning about the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, the week that Hurricane Helene had taken place. And so we also included the flooding in Asheville in 1916, and how historic that was and damaging. However, this was even more so. Another class that I teach is Climate Change Histories and Futures, where we read the novel by Octavia Butler, Parable of the Sower. And she grew up in Altadena, in Pasadena, California, and wrote about in the 1990s a climate-changed future, and wildfires devastating Los Angeles in 2025. And so we're seeing, if you look at various local community organizations and the types of responses that they are organizing and demanding, I find a lot of hope there, because they are asking for more attention to local knowledge and traditional knowledge, more leadership of indigenous groups, the groups who have been most heavily impacted by these problems that are the closest to the solution and can advise us, in each particular location what is best and how to proceed. And so it's just listening to those voices that's very crucial.
We have these calamities which seem to be more frequent, stronger, and have more severe damage to people and lives and property. But it sometimes feels, Tina, like we are the frog, the proverbial frog in the boiling pot of water. Yeah, we have these blips, but all is well until it's not. And we have Georgia peach farmers now wondering out loud whether they can continue to grow peaches in Georgia because it doesn't get cold enough in the winter for the buds to set on the tree. And they are not alone in terms of agriculture. So is policy going to change when farmers say, hey, we can't grow corn and wheat here anymore? It has to go to Canada. Or when insurers say, we're not going to insure your house because you're in a fire zone or a flood zone, and nobody can afford or get insurance. Is that where the rubber is going to hit the road?
I believe so. It's causing, I think the biggest concern is that ultimately climate change just exacerbates existing inequalities. And so we see, on one hand, we may see profiteering taking place, or what the journalist Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism, which these natural disasters can lead to efforts to privatize, public resources and land, and profiteer. And you see this with price gouging and rent, in Los Angeles right now, even though that is against the law. But then you also see more awareness being raised, and many predict that there, unfortunately, there may be or need to be a calamitous event that wakes people up, to demand more action
That
on
hasn't
behalf of.
happened yet. Alexander, in 2021, you wrote a guest essay in the New York Times, following Hurricane Ida's destruction in New Orleans, in which you said, quote, "We are now at the dawn of America's great climate migration era." And you said, "For now, it's piecemeal and moves are often temporary," predicting, of course, more to come. And that was also at the start of the Biden administration and was the year that marked the first time that the government officially reported on the link between climate change and migration. Biden did try to put in place some initiatives to prepare for all this, but we are a four-year government, it seems. And every 4 years, we have another election, and policies can and have changed. And they certainly changed yesterday. So did Biden do anything in a major way that would have helped this? And are we to anticipate that all of that will be reversed by the Trump administration?
I think largely we might expect that, yes. But I can't say for sure. Biden, as I mentioned a little bit ago, did, his administration did make an effort to unleash funding in a more proactive way to localities to take to make proactive adaptation efforts ahead of disasters, so through FEMA, through the Department of Housing and Urban Development, there are programs where communities get grants through, for buyout programs, for, what are sometimes called relocation programs, which, Octavia Butler, who, Tina, I'm so glad you mentioned, she predicted in Parable of the Sower that, we would see managed retreat from the shoreline, for example. In Wisconsin, we're seeing managed retreat from river valleys, a cluster of river communities relocating their towns partially or entirely. They're not alone. There's communities all across the nation that are doing this kind of relocation. This is something that has, got a little bit of wind under its sails under Biden. Under Trump, who's to say? I think we can largely expect that he will install leaders who actively undo the mission statements of their agencies.
So yesterday, speaking of which, in his inaugural address, Donald Trump said he would immediately sign executive orders declaring a national emergency at the border, allowing the deployment of troops. There is currently no emergency at the border, but he does want to stop illegal immigration, some of which will inevitably be due to climate. At the same time, he promised to declare a national energy emergency, which will allow him to unlock powers to speed permitting for oil and gas development, pipelines and the like. And he promised, of course, in his campaign to frack and drill, baby, drill. He also promised yesterday, he signed an executive order to take us out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Lawrence, are all of these things working at cross purposes? In other words, if you take us out of the Paris Climate Agreement and you drill, baby, drill, aren't you exacerbating the exact problem that they're trying to solve in this Paris Agreement and causing the inevitable thing you're trying to stop?
To a degree, we know that if countries like the US decide to claw back their climate commitments and stop trying to mitigate climate change, that will exacerbate the root causes of migration. We will see greater flows of people moving within and across borders. The question really is going to be how this new president decides to implement all of these ideas. We, for instance, if withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement, one of the sort of global agreements around cutting emissions, that is a very big step. It is to a degree a symbolic step, because what will matter is really how the US decides to implement its own policies around around climate change. So we have a lot to see. It's too early for us to figure that one out.
I have 30 seconds, Lawrence. If America pulls out of the Paris Climate Accords, can the world make a difference without us?
Absolutely. Other countries will have to step up, though.
Will they?
That I can't answer, but we'll see.
Okay. Well, trying to stay apolitical because they are a nonpartisan group, the Migration Policy Institute, where Lawrence Huang is a policy analyst. Alexandra Tempest is a freelance journalist who has written extensively about this topic. And Tina Schull is associate professor of public history with a focus on migration and migration policy at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.